Hi, everyone. I'm Natalie Gochner. This is Both Sides of the Aisle, and I represent the political center and have on the political left, Shireen Gourbani.
Hello, and hey, listeners. Special shout out to, I believe your name was Julie. We met at the grocery store this week. We so appreciate people tuning in.
Love our listeners. And on the political right, Representative Ryan Wilcox.
Hi, good to be here. Thank you.
Yeah, great to see you, Ryan. We're in studio, and let's go through several issues, both national, international, and start with President Biden, Shireen, saying it was a good day for world peace when he signed the $95 billion military spending package for Ukraine, Israel, and Taiwan. That was a long time in coming.
Long time coming. Many delays on this for a variety of reasons, but I actually heard a pretty interesting interview with Mitch McConnell, who said really the problem was in our house, right? With Republicans getting people on board for this. But ultimately, I think through kind of old-fashioned diplomacy in the sense of really working with people, trying to share information, good information, which we don't always have. I think it's an interesting framing around considering this a good day for peace. This is a good day for war, right? Mm-hmm. When we're talking about the kind of money that we're investing in military, I wish that we wouldn't conflate these issues in the way that we do. I think that we can move towards greater global stabilization with these kinds of investments, but the way that we go about them is continually reinvesting in the military-industrial complex. That's what we do as a nation.
Ryan, this is peace through strength in the Reagan terminology.
Is it, though?
Yeah.
I don't know. What are we at now? $600 billion in the last year or two? Where does that end? You know, one of the last things that I heard this week was that Ukraine is negotiating a deal with the administration right now so that there's ongoing funding through the next administration that's required, regardless of who happens to be president.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What does that even mean?
Like, yeah.
We're not. It's bad enough we don't even vote to go to war anymore. I don't know. How much of the Constitution are we going to ignore?
Yeah. Ryan, how about those chilling numbers that the estimates are that in this war, Israel has now killed over 34,000 people in Gaza. It's been 6 months. 14,000 of that 34 are children.
And the stats on starvation are also horrific. It's heartbreaking.
I mean, it's...
There's no happy side to war. There's just not it's over.
Yeah.
That's it.
Yeah, I'm with you. Shireen, I guess now we're ready for this next move where Israel plans to do a ground invasion of Rafah. The U.S. publicly opposes that. Buckle up, huh?
Yeah, so I think we're heading into a greater time of, death and destruction, right?
Mm-hmm,
And it does seem to me that there is a bit of a changing tide when we think about the way, and I'm sure we'll get to it, but the way that people are bringing attention to this issue across our nation, when we think about even the protests that are happening inside of Israel, really saying, what is the end game here?
Mm-hmm.
They want the hostages back. They want their family members back. Very reasonably so, right? But it doesn't seem like Netanyahu has a plan here other than to just continue to ravage war on a nation that is, well, not a nation, on a group of people that have no way to really defend themselves.
Yeah. Ryan, I've shared this story with Shireen before, but when I worked in the Levitt administration, once had a meeting with Benjamin Netanyahu, Bibi,
wow,
as they call him. He was not in office at the time.
Yeah.
And it was pre-Olympics. It was during the Olympic torch relay, and we would go to cities and cities and have Utah receptions, and he was there, and so Governor
wow.
Levitt met with him. But I remember him saying to Governor Levitt, of course, this was in the 9/11, you know, terrorist time, but I remember him mm-hmm. saying to Mike Levitt, America loves a glorious war. And I looked at him like, wow, this guy's war-minded.
Yeah.
And it just sort of has played out for me as I've watched this.
You know, we were talking a little bit earlier about, you know, why people do the things they do.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't imagine what it would be like to live in a place like Israel, where your enemies are openly threatening you on a regular basis.
And close.
Put you
and close.
Close, like right
yeah.
there.
Yeah.
Right? And, you know, even I think one of the hardest things for me to stomach with all of this, I mean, this is a total disaster. One of the hardest things for me to stomach with all of this is our sort of duplicity as foreign policy, where we are literally funding both sides.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we gave money to Iran. They launched missiles at Israel. And then we send signals whether or not, you know, how hard they can hit back.
Mm-hmm.
And then we fund the Palestinians. And then we fund the Israelis. and back and forth. And what is this other than just massive scale deception, pretending like we don't see because people aren't paying attention? I don't.
Well, I would ask. I would actually argue that what it is a country disinterested in true peace. Right? If we actually thought about flipping the ideological framework around global domination, we might get different results, but we don't, right? Mm-hmm. So we kind of keep playing into the same patterns of behavior with often the same and frankly devastating results.
Yeah.
Yes, we went from the Abraham Accords, moving the embassy, all of that kind of stuff, to verge of World War III if it hasn't already started.
But you don't think some of those things directly contributed to increasing hostilities in that region? I mean, what did you think the Abraham Accords accomplished?
At the time?
At all.
I love them because they created more modernity and connection between the Arab world and the rest of the world. And I visited Dubai and UAE and saw how that connection with Tel Aviv was so healthy in my mind, because now they have direct flights and they're integrated rather than separated. Yep. So I'm a big fan of the Abraham Accords, what I know of them.
I think if we just stayed on that path, instead of the path that we've gone down since then, I think we're in a dramatically different place.
Okay, but I mean, we're not the ones who changed direction. The change in direction came from Israel.
Absolutely.
Well, it came from Hamas.
Middle East. Absolutely not.
Moment.
Especially towards Iran. Like, we sent the exact opposite message.
It is
to Iran,
but okay, continue.
Okay.
I'm Iranian, so
okay.
It matters to
Iran.
Me.
Iran.
Hey, but okay, but take us, it's graduation week. Shireen, take us to college campuses. I'm heartbroken for these students at USC that don't get their graduation, their commencement ceremonies. My son was a COVID graduate, University of Utah, and he's now reminding me that he has no idea what a graduation ceremony is like, looks like. And I'm like, oh my gosh, he missed this.
Same class.
Okay, yeah. He missed
through that in high school.
Missed this. And so I'm sort of like, this is a loss. I mean, there's a way to have foreign policy that you disagree with without forcing these institutions to, you know, for safety reasons, to close their ceremonies.
Yeah, I've been very interested in the discourse and reporting on this, in part because it seems like university campuses used to be a place of great political action and discontent and pushing boundaries. And it does seem wholly like we've forgotten how to do that. And then the response mechanisms feel deeply out of whack.
I feel like the whole time I was at the university, there was a camp established on apartheid.
Yes. Yeah.
And it was just sort of, you know, you go learn about it. And it was like disagreeing better.
Yeah.
In to quote our governor.
Yeah, you would think.
But
yeah.
not so today. Did you want to say anything, Ryan, about what's happening on college campuses?
It's embarrassing.
Mm-hmm. You saw what Speaker Johnson got booed at Columbia.
Okay, but I just also have to say, what Speaker Johnson did was come to Columbia and say that Biden should bring in
National Guard.
And if for me, that is a person so deeply out of touch with history. First of all, the president does not call in the National Guard. The governor would do that if that's what happened. But is Speaker Johnson a person who doesn't have the lyrics, Tin Soldiers and Nixon's Coming, or the image of that woman on Kent State's campus, like blazed into his mind? Like, how do you get so deeply out of touch with what actually happened when we did call the National Guard?
National Guard protest.
I can't let that one go. I can't let that one go because the National Guard is what we did when we were dealing with the civil rights issues in Alabama. We called in the National Guard to help with integration. Right. So, the National Guard isn't by default this, you know, terrible thing because of one way it was used one time. There is an appropriate use for that in higher education. Right?
Yeah, but shooting unarmed protesters and creating those kinds of environments.
Nobody's talking about shooting them.
I'm into all
that. That's what happened at Kent State. That actually happened.
But the exact opposite happened in Alabama. They protected the black students who were being admitted for the first time and the rights they should have had all along. They kept it peaceful when there was chaos there. And I think that's more than likely, I don't know Speaker Johnson, but I'm thinking more than likely that's what was going through the guy's mind, right?
Hey, I have
like a false dichotomy.
I keep doing all these personal anecdotes today, but my sister lived in Ohio, and I used to go back in the summers and help her with her kids while she was a student at Kent State.
Oh, wow.
But I would push the children around in a stroller and go to that monument. Yeah, it's blazed in my mind. Okay, the Supreme Court and their arguments about the immunity case, fascinating. I found it fascinating.
What stood out for you?
Well, it was just so fun for me to hear the rule of law being debated and these uber intelligent people going after, you know, thinking about how do you define private acts? How do you define official acts? I'm sure our producer, Anthony Scoma, liked this because he's in law school. But I thought it was wonderful to see our system working. Now, we still don't know where it's going to end. Shireen's looking at me like, Natalie, that I'm skeptical.
We'll see.
But I really liked seeing the law played out right in front of our eyes. Comments?
Ryan, did you follow?
Not closely enough. You know, some of this stuff, there's how many lawsuits and cases right now? It's just, I don't know.
Yeah. Well, it makes you glad that you've got a variety of them in there, because clearly some are going to rule in a way that I don't think they should, and others are going to be, you know, more in the middle. But it's going to be fun to see where it lands.
I'll just say it does seem like there was an initial run from the Trump camp on basically total immunity, and that has gone out the window. Yeah. So where this line gets drawn is really interesting, and I do, you know, hope that the decisions that are made here put us in a stronger place for our democracy.
Yeah. Well, there needs to be a line, right, between private acts and official acts. And it's not clear what that is.
And we're going to get it.
That's why we have the
Supreme
Court.
We're going to get it. Yeah. Okay. We've got lots to talk about. It was a convention weekend. So let's take a short break, and I'll be right back with Ryan Wilcox and Shireen Gurbani.
You're listening to Both Sides of the Aisle on Utah Public Radio. We love to hear from listeners like you. If you would like to send us a comment, email bsotapodcast@gmail.com. That's bsotapodcast@gmail.com. Thanks for listening. Shireen Gurbani on the left.
And Ryan Wilcox on the right.
Natalie Gochner, I'm in the political center, and I'm so glad to be with my two friends, kind of corralling them, but also leading a discussion. And I am so excited, Ryan, to ask you about the Republican state convention, which was held this weekend. 4,000 Republican delegates, Salt Palace in downtown. And boy, were they anti our sitting governor, who has some sort of approval rating that's pretty darn 70%. High. Yeah. Cox said to them, "I love you guys." And one guy yelled back, "We don't love you." Let's hear your reaction to that.
You know, it's weird, but almost no one is ever insulted into agreement.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Like, mm-hmm. You get the phrase, you get more bees with honey, you know, with flowers, that kind of thing. It's just such a strange way to try to get somebody on your side.
Mm-hmm.
That said, I don't think that was the goal.
Yeah.
Right? The goal was, I want to yell. I want to express my displeasure, which is also fully American. You know, I mean, we just got done talking about the protests at college campuses.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of similar yelling, protesting kind of thing. And there was very much that sentiment there at the convention on Saturday.
Yeah. Shireen, for a sitting governor with a 70-some-odd percent approval rating to only get a third of the delegates at his own convention.
Which he won 4 years ago.
Okay.
He won the convention 4 years
ago. Yeah, that's right. A great point, Ryan. That says something about our times. Maybe it says something about Phil Lyman. Maybe he's an incredibly attractive candidate. I don't know.
So I want to go back to just one of the logistical conversations that we often have around how difficult it actually is to participate in this form of democratic engagement, mm-hmm. right? So the convention, I believe, started at 8 a.m. and ended at midnight.
Crazy.
Yeah. So when you think about who can give that kind of time, and what really, like, the, if I'm not mistaken, the vote for governor did not happen until past 5 o'clock. So at this point, you'd already been there for a full working day, you know, where when we think about the amount of time and that people give. So I ended up down there because it was actually also USA Fencing's, I believe, qualifying finals for who they're sending to the Olympics. And I have a little kid who's interested in fencing, so I ended up walking around down there. And I will say it is like a pretty interesting space to be in, having been to the Democratic convention many mm-hmm. times. I've never been to the Republican convention until this year. the way that people engage in the space is different. And I do feel like there's more on the table, right? We mm-hmm. know that Democrats have a hard time breaking through in the state.
Yeah. You're in the power play role.
You're in the power play. Yeah. Mm-hmm. In the Republican Party, you are in the power play role. And so the stakes, I'm sure, feel so much higher. But the amount of, I would say, just kind of anger mm-hmm. that I felt in just kind of casual, like overhearing casual conversations walking around was surprising to me.
Yeah.
But perhaps aligns a bit with some of the outcomes that we saw.
Okay. So I was a first state delegate in 2000. And I remember Governor Leavitt being booed at that mm-hmm. convention out at the East Center.
I was there. Yeah.
And, you know, like, okay. 2004, you know, when his replacement race was happening. And I remember also, and this is a Democratic convention thing that I went to, but do you remember when Matheson, when they returned their back to Matheson? Congressman Matheson?
Yeah, I wasn't there, but yes.
Okay, so I remember watching that one going, oh, that's dumb. Republicans wouldn't do that.
Yeah, watch that. Hey, yeah. Ryan, you seem too young to me to have been at the Leavitt one in his final one, but I'm glad we
old.
Shared that. Yeah. I'm glad we shared that. But I will say, you know, he got primaried, as they say. He didn't lose. In other words, a sitting governor was amazed, you know, that he had to go through a primary, but he still won the convention. But it's completely flopped from that. And I got a whole bunch of thoughts, but let me just throw this one out. Is it Rob Axton? Am I getting the Republican?
Rob Axon.
Axon.
A-X-S-O-N. Yeah.
Rob is a good guy. He's working really hard to do what he can with the Republican Party. But he has publicly expressed that one of his goals is to engage young people.
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness. I can't think of a worse way to engage young people than to have a convention system that takes your entire Saturday.
Yeah.
I can't think of a worse way to engage young people than to have a presidential preference poll.
Right.
Instead of, you know, using technology to do what we need to do. So anyway, there's something that's just not right. Let me read a quote just because it's so, I mean, I got to give credit to Governor Cox for speaking his mind and doing it in an articulate way. But he says, maybe you're booing me because you hate that I signed the largest tax cut in Utah history. Maybe you hate that I signed constitutional carry into law. Maybe you hate that we ended CRT, DEI, and ESG. Or maybe you hate that I don't hate enough. Pretty good, Shereen.
Pretty good. I'll just say that entire list of things before that is
pretty bad.
Not things that you like.
Yeah, not great. But I do wonder that. I wonder then, if the performative politics that, again, has real consequences in people's lives, these culture war issues that have taken precedence mm-hmm. and often are some of the top priorities when we think about how quickly bills move through or what comes first on the agenda, the energy and activity around those kinds of anti-bills mm-hmm. aren't setting with mm-hmm. this group of voters.
Yeah.
So what is? That's what I want to know.
So
what
the governor's done what they wanted, and he still gets booed. Yeah.
Well, this is back to, you know, why people do what they do. This clearly is not about a principled position, because Governor Cox, Speaker Wilson, together pushed all of these different things through that theoretically conservative delegates would love and do and say that they do. Problem is, we haven't stuck to that as a party. And clearly there's something else that they don't like, which is, I think, why the governor went to that line at the end. And I did confirm that that wasn't a written part of his speech. He most often gives speeches off the cuff. He doesn't usually have somebody write anything for him. But that's, I think, what we heard on Saturday was his visceral reaction to what he was experiencing.
So you're saying that maybe I don't hate enough. He did extemporaneously.
Yeah.
Wow.
That's what he was feeling in the moment.
Yeah.
And that really bothers me.
And I love that in politicians when they speak their mind. So good on him.
He's great at that. You know, say he rolls with what he's feeling at the moment. And I think it usually works. But what worries me about this is the constant use of the word hatred.
Mm-hmm.
Because are we really at the place where we're so contemptuous with each other that we literally believe in the worthlessness of the other?
Yeah.
That strongly that, you know, that's where we're at. And that can't be it. That is not where I believe Utah is. We're just not. I mean, it's just not.
Hey, Shereen, so why is this happening? I told you I made a list.
Yeah.
Okay, so I've got on my list distribution of income, loss of the middle class, failure of public education, technology and its impact on our lives, pushing us towards loneliness, isolation, decline in religion, decline in families, and COVID.
Yeah.
I don't know. What's on your list? Is that a pretty good list?
That's a good list. I mean, for me, a big one at the heart of it is a media system that has also changed dramatically. When we think about the decline of local reporting, the amount of information that people receive that is really tuned into their political ideology that just creates that kind of echo chamber and reinforces beliefs they already have. And then not being able to see that, right, which ties back to the issue around education, I think, kind of critical thinking and in mass, as information's coming at you. So these are really critical things, I think. I also feel like we do have a real sense of kind of segregation. People who kind of think like-mindedly are living more together. We also have, I do think, then that bleeds into schools. It bleeds into broader social structures. You're not mixing as often with people who think differently.
Yeah. How did you like my list, Ryan?
It's a pretty solid list. You know, the decline of our institutions of civil society, that's one that's weighed on me for a decade or more. And not that I even have a solution to it, but watching all of these institutions that promoted healthy societies just disappear over the last decade and be replaced by what? Cell phone? I don't even know. I don't even know what that looks like. So we're scrambling now in the schools. We're scrambling with things we never used to have to worry about. I spent more time in the last 2 years studying school shooters than I could have ever imagined. I would have had to. Why would I have to do that?
Yeah.
But that I think those are all tied into. And then when you talk about, you know, we just ran through the list and it did sound sort of funny when you said it on Saturday. But, you know, CRT, DEI and ESG, all of these things for people who, you know, at the convention, those things are in their minds are just more evidence of government itself attacking their personal values, attacking the things that they believe in. And so, yeah, that should be something that they're happy about.
Not a time to be happy.
Not a time to be happy.
How about our Lieutenant Governor Ryan tweeting out that conventions are not a place for families? And she, you know, took some of her extended family to see her, you know, in her role as Lieutenant Governor and just was horrified. And even someone like Representative Kara Berkland in the Utah House, someone who I would think would like the convention, but she just said, nope, this didn't work for me.
Yeah.
I don't think she said that. She's super concerned about her daughter's experience.
Yeah. But right? Feeling like they were also harassed.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I have to say, just like the vibes were not good. Like, okay. The experience is tough. And I also think that it continues to be kind of a tough place for, as you were suggesting, young people. But I don't know. The system feels broken.
So I want to be honest about how I think we got here.
Okay.
And I already talked about the 2000 convention. I know that, you know, started some of those conversations about what became SB 54. The conventions after that, the 2008.
That's the Count My Vote bill.
Count
My
Vote bill.
That made it so signatures can get you on the ballot.
So what that has done is it's left, because it's left that absent path that you can completely ignore the convention, it's disincentivized people to participate in the caucus system, which really just leaves people who are more conservative, who not that conservatism is the
extreme
problem.
Yeah, radicalized, whatever.
Whatever that is, right? More of the average voter has less of an incentive to participate in the caucus system is the reality right now. And so fewer of those are going to be elected delegates. And so that itself, the existence of that other path has also helped to radicalize the conventions.
And Ryan, the way I would see that is that the conventions aren't going to win this. There'll come a time when we won't do them anymore. That's my prediction. Smiles? I don't know.
I would just say
that could be, but I think that's a disaster.
The county conventions, I feel like, will probably continue. It seems like there's good organizing and reasons to have those. These state conventions, I don't know.
Yeah. Hey, Shireen, I don't want to ignore the Democrats. And there were a lot of things coming out there. We've got Brian King as the gubernatorial candidate, Carolyn Gleick as the
Senate
seat, Bill Campbell, first congressional district, Brian Adams, second, Glenn Wright, third, and Katrina Falik Wang in the fourth.
And I'll just say, we need to get into this because some wild things are happening in in my party too.
Yeah.
So, give us a hint.
So
just
we'll
a hint.
Have to
we got
save,
1 minute
we'll
on the
have
program.
We'll have to save it for next time. I guess I'll just say that they're, one of the most interesting pieces is that it does seem like the CD2 candidate, which I was also, it appears to be a mega extremist who got through. They decided to move forward with a nomination because if that person then resigns, then there's an ability to put somebody else in. But the entire thing is a hot mess.
Well, the first district candidate, Bill Campbell, was a Republican running as a Republican two cycles ago.
Pretty sure John Curtis used to be a Democrat. So this happens.
Not within a day.
Really interesting. Okay, well, that's just a sign that both sides of the aisle is going to continue to be interesting. Want to thank our listeners. Thank Shireen. Thank Ryan. Thank you, Anthony Scoma, for producing the program. That's a wrap.